Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show. This is Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna, and it's the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion, and we want to begin our program today with a message that General Dwight Eisenhower delivered to Allied forces in 1944.
The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world.
Now, Eisenhower went on to say that their task would not be an easy one, and indeed it was not. More than 160,000 Allied troops stormed the beaches of Normandy that day, and more than 9,000 perished on that very first landing on Omaha Beach. World leaders gathered in France to commemorate this day, including Massachusetts' own Congressman Stephen Lynch. We'll hear from him a little later in the show, and we'll speak about the significance of the day with a military historian who spent more than 20 years as an Army officer. But we wanted to begin the hour by honoring and remembering those who served that day, three quarters of a century ago, to ensure the cause of freedom endured. For many people listening out there, our next guest barely needs an introduction. He's a successful fashion designer and now one of the Emmy Award-winning Fab Five on Netflix's Queer Eye.
You'll often find me sporting a French tuck. Now, French tuck is simple. All you have to do is tuck in the front of your shirt into your pants. It's going to balance your proportions and help you look taller and leaner.
That's right. Tan France, master of the French tuck. He joins us now in studio. He's in town for a sold-out Harvard bookstore event on his new memoir, Naturally Tan. Tan France, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hello, mate. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
So well.
Thank you for doing this.
What do you think of Boston?
I visited here a month ago. It's gorgeous. Gorgeous. It looks quite English, weirdly.
Well, it's New England.
Oh my God, is that the state?
No, it's
Boston's
the region.
The okay.
It's in Massachusetts, part of New England.
Okay.
But that's why we call it New England.
I don't know my American geography, I'm sorry.
It's okay. I just want to remind our listeners that we're streaming this conversation on Facebook Live. There's a link at our website, radioboston.org. And we actually want to invite you into the conversation with Tan France. Do you have fashion questions that you've just been itching to have answered? Do you maybe disagree with Tan on things like Crocs or other fashion do or don'ts? Give us a call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can send us a tweet. We're at Radio Boston. So, okay, we'd heard about the French tuck there at the top.
Yes.
And I'm just not sure if I'm a convert yet, but a lot of people are. GQ said that Google searches for the French tuck spiked after the new Queer Eye second season came out.
Yeah.
Are you seeing more of them out in the world? How does that make
Everywhere.
You feel to be like a force behind that?
It's bizarre. So here's the thing. The French tuck was around way before I was, but it does feel weird to know that people are doing it because I've encouraged them to do it. It's weird to think somebody's doing anything because I've encouraged them to do it, let alone people all over the world are doing the French tuck. No matter where I go, no matter what country I go to, that's the first thing people want to show me when they see me in real life.
And I mean, full disclosure, I'm a little full figured, and so the idea of a French tuck kind of doesn't sit well with me.
I have to disagree. I think it works on anyone.
So I should try it?
I think you should.
Okay. So you wrote this fascinating book, Naturally Tan.
Yes.
And in it, you write about your parents having dreams for you to be a doctor or a lawyer.
Yes.
And you know, as a fellow child of immigrants, I can relate to that. So
yeah.
How did you come to fashion and clothing?
Well, my granddad owned a factory that created denim for Disney, and I learned to sew at a very young age. I wasn't working there, just to clarify. I would go and visit because I loved being there. The space was fantastic, and I learned to sew. And then when I decided on what career path I wanted to take, fashion was the only option for me. However, because that wasn't really a thing in my community, I found a way to make sure that I could do it without being scolded for it. So I just didn't tell them. I didn't tell them. I decided to go to fashion college, and they thought that I was going to college for psychology until my graduation.
So the answer is to lie.
Yeah. You know, sometimes lying is the way.
So tell me about the first piece of clothing that you connected with, that you loved.
The first piece of clothing was a piece of clothing that I actually didn't own and that never existed. But it was a piece of clothing that I remember very distinctly. I wanted more than anything in the world. You know when you were six, or remember when you were like six, seven, eight, whatever, you wanted like toys for your birthday. What toy did you want for your birthday? Just do you remember roughly?
Honestly?
Like Cabbage Patch Kids?
No, I wanted one of those Super Soaker things.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. That's the kind of thing that a 6 or 7 year old wants.
Yeah.
I did not want that.
What did you want?
I wanted a custom-made black silk shirt. And I was obsessed with that. And I asked for it for my birthday for many years, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I never got it. So that's the first time I really remember thinking, clothes are clearly very significant to me if that's what I'm asking for my birthday.
So we have a couple of calls here before we get to the next part of our conversation. So I want to see if we can squeeze in a few callers here. Andrea is calling from the Back Bay. Andrea, what's your question for Tan France?
Hi, Tan.
Hello.
Love you and your show. You guys are great.
Thank you.
My question for you is, a lot of the times, especially the French tuck, when it comes to men, sometimes make it look like the back of their shirt has come untucked.
Ah.
So do you have any tips on how to make it look like you didn't start with your shirt tucked in and like you just look sloppy?
I mean, I'm hoping that the people... So there is another piece of advice I give, and I think it's season two, maybe it's actually season three. I get my seasons mixed up, where I do tell people of America to invest in an iron and actually iron everything. It seems to be very common. Almost every one of my friends refuses to iron clothes. And so if they start out ironed, the back should still be relatively well-pressed. And so it should be quite obvious that it was never fully tucked. Let's hope so. And then also, don't go for something super, super long. Go for something that is the correct size and length for you, and then hopefully it won't look so sloppy.
Oh, so it won't hang down super long.
Yes.
One more question here from Rocco in West Boylston. Rocco, you're on Radio Boston.
Hey there. Thanks for taking the call. So I just got this new job very high up in an organization, a school district, but I hate wearing ties. And so, you know, that's like the thing that people have to do, and I'm wondering if there are options, you know, besides your traditional suit with a tie that can be done these days to still look professional, still be respected, but not to be choked out every day.
Yes. First off, congratulations, Rocco. That's wonderful that you have a new job. And as far as your wardrobe goes, I don't think you need a tie these days to show your position. I think that you can wear a suit with a polo shirt underneath, or even a t-shirt, as long as it's something simple and classic and crisp and clean. And so I would say go without the tie. It's very, very rare I wear a tie, but I will go to a red carpet event, which is the most formal thing you'll go to, and I go without a tie. So maybe try a shirt buttoned up all the way without a tie. But if that's still feeling like it's choking you, I would try a polo or a Mandarin collar shirt or even a t-shirt on every now and then with a suit.
That's Tan France of Queer Eye. He's joining us here in studio. And if you have a question for him, our phone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tan, I'd like to play a clip from season one.
Yes.
Where you did a makeover of a man named Corey Waldrop in Georgia.
Yes.
He's a veteran, NASCAR fan, Trump supporter. And so perhaps just about the opposite of you.
No, that describes me perfectly.
And you had a touching moment where you were going through his closet with him and found a lot of his dad's clothes. Mm-hmm. So let's listen to that.
Why is it that you keep your dad's clothing in here?
I guess that's the way that I still connect with him. He loved my mom. He loved us.
Mm-hmm.
And just didn't get much better than him.
Mm-hmm.
Just an all-around great guy.
Can I give you a hug? Oh, I'm sorry, mate.
It's a very touching moment. Mm-hmm. What was going through your head in that moment?
That was only the second episode we ever filmed, so it was my second week on set. What was going through my head was I can't believe how vulnerable this man is willing to be with a complete stranger. That was the first hour that I met him, and he was willing to be so open with me. And I just thought, wow, what we're going to go through over the next few weeks as we film the show is going to be so impactful on my life. Hopefully there's two, but I just thought this is going to make me feel compassion like I've never known before.
Well, and that's sort of one of the central themes of the show, yeah. Right? This idea of overcoming differences, showing that a gay British man of South Asian descent can have an intimate moment with a Trump voter yeah. in his closet.
Yeah.
Is that difficult?
No. I think for many it would be, but I am a South Asian man in what I was in England. I now live in the US, so now I'm an immigrant. Believe me, I've had a lifetime of training when it comes to people being somewhat negative towards me. And so I know how to combat that. I know how to approach that. I lead with kindness and tolerance and accept any question, no matter how disrespectful they may seem. I will accept those questions and answer them. I was trained my whole life for this.
Well, and you actually write about that in the book very beautifully about some of the incredibly racist way that people have treated you growing up and now and the slurs and harassment, and especially after 9/11, the fact that you are routinely pulled aside in the airport for questioning. How have you come to terms with all of that, or have you?
I have. Again, it's all I've ever known. If that was all you ever knew, you'd find a way to accept it and move on. It's not great, and now I'm in a position to be able to call that behavior out. But it's something I found a way to reconcile. And so what I do is I understand how it makes me feel, and I know that I don't want anyone else to feel that way. So I speak out about it, and I will against it, and I will speak to the people who are throwing those assaults at me, that abuse at me, and ask them why they feel it's okay, what they think that I've done that would warrant such a reaction. It's a very uncomfortable conversation, and I don't think they're ever expecting me to confront them that way. I think they're used to people swearing at them. I know that that doesn't achieve anything, so I'd rather just say, I know that you think that the most common thing used to be, we pay for you to live. Like, my taxes pay for you. My reaction was always...
What does that even mean?
Well, because I was in their country, air quotes. You're here as an immigrant, and so therefore you must be taking advantage of our system. No, I had a job. My parents were in that country. They had many jobs to make sure that we were providing...
Well, and you say in the book very strongly, this is my country.
This is my country. I was born and raised in that country. The Brits colonized our country, and then I had therefore a right to be in the UK. And so, so when people are throwing that abuse at me, I very calmly give a rebuttal.
And I just want to remind our listeners, if you want to join us, our phone number is 1-800-423-8255 if you have any fashion questions for Tan France. Tan, I also want to ask you about another thing you wrote in the book, it's in a couple of places, but... Early on, you say you don't want to be asked by interviewers about religion and that it's a very personal thing for you. But then later on, you write about how important your representation is on TV and that you, quote, hope that there comes a time when there is no need to talk about being queer or gay or Muslim. And so I guess my question, I was thinking this while reading, if we're not in that place where there's no need to talk about it, then why not talk about it?
Let me explain. In my opinion, there's no reason to talk about it. And I've been thinking about this a lot over the last few days. There's no real reason for me to break down who I am or what my community is all about. I think just by being visible, people know that I'm South Asian. You can see it. People now know that I'm Muslim. I've spoken about it enough, or just mentioned it enough. There's no reason to speak out more about it other than to just be. When you are a white man, I can't imagine that in any interview they'd say, hey, so you're white, tell me about how that feels. There's no, you just are. You represent by just being. And that's how I feel about who I am at this point. I don't talk about the ins and outs of being gay anymore, really, other than I'm gay.
It
I'm brown.
It just is.
It just is. That is just so.
But you also write in the book about growing up, you know, yearned to see people like you reflected on television.
Yeah.
And now you're that person, perhaps for thousands or millions of people around the world. I mean,
and that's,
is that a heavy responsibility?
It is. It really is. But the way I do it now in particular is just by being on the show. I don't talk about religion. On the show, I don't talk about my upbringing. I just am there. I am doing the same job as everybody else. And I love that it's just normalizing who we are, what we do. We are just the same as everybody else. I'm on a show that's a makeover show, that's a make better show, that was helping human connection. And so I don't belabor any of those points. It comes up in conversation because it's an important part of me, but that's not the only part of me. My sexuality, my religion, they're all secondary. First and foremost, I am a person, and I'm equal to my peers on the show. And so that's how I feel about my responsibility. Yes, I feel a responsibility to represent my community well, and therefore I try and make sure that I'm being the best version of myself that I can be, and that is how I'd represent.
You also write in the book about skin tone, color, race, and how at one point in your life you tried bleaching your skin. And I want to ask you about that. I mean, were you ashamed of who you were, or how did you become more comfortable in your own skin?
No, I want to make this really clear. It wasn't that I was ashamed of who I was. I was ashamed of myself that I tried bleaching my skin. I tried bleaching my skin because in my culture and in many cultures, especially in the Middle East, in South Asia, in Far East Asia, they are encouraged to be as light as physically possible, because the lighter you are, the more successful you will be, the more successful marriage you will, partner you will get for a successful marriage. It is ever present in our community. The fairer the skin, the more successful you will be. And I'd known that from the time I was born. And so that I succumbed to the pressure. And that's what I'm ashamed of. And now I feel relief that I did it for a few days. It hurt. No desire to ever do it again. And now I'm in a position where, thank God, I love my color. And I encourage people very often on my Instagram to embrace their color. If they're beautifully brown, they are beautifully brown.
Well, thank you for talking about those difficult issues with us
here. Worries.
I want to, again, try and invite in some of our listeners, if that's okay with you.
Let's
go to Rebecca. She's calling from New Hampshire. Rebecca, you're on Radio Boston with Tan France.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm a huge fan, so happy to talk to you.
Thanks, Rebecca.
So my question is about, how do you approach people without making it sound as though it's critiquing? I've noticed on the show that you guys do such a fantastic job of taking someone where they are and helping them really accept themselves through their appearance. Mm-hmm. And so if there's someone that you know that you would like to give a suggestion to, but you want it to be out of a place of love and not criticism, how do you do that?
First and foremost, for me, it's in my tone. Okay, I will say this. I have the luxury of an English accent in America, and you guys afford me a bit of wiggle room like you don't afford each other, which is very good for me. But what I will say is I've done this with my partner. There are things that definitely weren't working for him, and so I would make it very clear simply by doing this. I highlight the things that are great, and I talk about how wonderful they are. The things that aren't great, I don't mention those things, and then hopefully they'll get the gist that maybe he's not responding so well to this thing that I'm trying on today. But if that's still not working, I will say, look, you have so many wonderful options in your wardrobe that make you feel great about yourself. This is one of those things that definitely doesn't make you feel good, and people aren't responding well to it. Maybe avoid that item and go for the better things in your wardrobe. In my opinion, it's all about your tone and your delivery. And if it's coming from a good place, hopefully it will be received as such.
Well, so Bob is calling from his car on the Mass Pike, and he has a question about his wardrobe. Bob, you're on Radio Boston.
Hello, Bob.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for doing the show today.
Thank you so much.
Here's my deal. I just turned 60, and I've spent a lot of years neglecting both myself and my wardrobe, and thanks to doing ayahuasca work and a whole bunch of other things, I'm a new me, and I'm wanting to pay more attention to my wardrobe.
Yes.
And I don't cut the same figure I did when I used to care.
Yes.
So I have no idea where to start. I mean, I was kind of like a Brooks Brothers kind of guy, and I don't know. That feels dated and old-fashioned. Don't know where to go.
Okay.
Thanks, Bob. And hey, I'm a Brooks Brothers kind of guy. I don't know. Help us out.
Okay. Bob, I actually love the question. Thank you so much for that. My response is this. I don't know if you're on social media. If not, no problem. I would suggest that you look for somebody that you see in the media that you think they're a well-dressed person. They're of a similar age. They have a life that I think I can connect with. So find that one person in the public eye that you think I would like to look more like that guy. Yes, I know that people in the media usually have a great budget for that kind of stuff, but there are always cheaper, more accessible versions of what famous people are wearing. So I would, if I were you, I would Google. Let's say, for example, it's George Clooney. George Clooney's style. Find a bunch of pictures online, and when you go shopping, think, would George Clooney buy this, or would he not? Would he wear this, or would he not? And then use that as a jumping off point. Also, store assistants are there for a reason. They know the product better than you will ever know. Use your resources. So go in with a plan. I want to look more like George Clooney. He wears this kind of jean. He wears this kind of shirt. He wears this kind of suit. And then ask the store assistants, hey, have you got anything that might look like this? And they will hopefully offer you some wonderful advice.
Even on a budget.
Even on a budget. Of course on a budget. Yes.
So I want to ask you about another thing I noticed in the book. And I'm sorry if I might push your buttons here.
Go.
But, okay. So there are multiple places in the memoir where you write about folks who hurt you, who wronged you, mm-hmm. who were mean to you when you were a kid or said mean things to you in your DMs. And each time you kind of have a strong reaction back at them, deleting their Facebook requests. And I will never, basically calling them out.
Yeah.
And so I guess I'm wondering why it was important for you to include those anecdotes in your memoir.
Because,
are you still hurting? Do you want to talk it out?
No, I'm not still hurting. The reason why I included that is because I want people to see that I am still very much a person. If I went on this show, if you went on this show and you had people from your old life who were wanting to be part of your life because you had just, let's say, for example, you won the lottery. They wanted to be a part of your life because
Dream about it every day.
Lovely, right?
Yeah.
They wanted to be a part of your life. Would you really respond well to that? No, you'd be like, no, the reason why you want to now date me is because I just won the lottery. So I wanted this book to be very clear. I am still very much Tan. And therefore, if somebody is ludicrous and they are crazy enough to send me a message to say, hey, we should hang out more, when they haven't contacted me in 15 years, I need them to know I'm still Tan. Very much Tan.
And you still hurt me then. And...
yes.
Okay. We're rapidly running out of time, so I want to make sure we fit in a few things, maybe quick hits, okay? What are some top summer tips that you can offer to our listeners and Facebook Live viewers?
Go for color. Summer, it's so hard to layer because it's obviously so hot. And so if you want to add that point of interest, go for color. Everybody knows me for print. I love a print. But if you really want to stay on trend and be really, really trendy, sheer is huge. Sheer. Apparently, I was saying that in a way that people didn't understand earlier on. So, sheer.
Well, here in Boston, you can say sheer.
Sheer. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hello. Oh, my gosh. I can do the Boston accent. Who knew? Wear something under it because that's very daring if you don't. But sheer options are always wonderful. And then also avoid flip-flops. Please.
So why do you hate flip-flops and Crocs so much?
Crocs, well, because Crocs. And flip-flops, unless you're on a beach or by a pool, they just don't. They're so unsightly. They're so, and they are telling the world you've made no effort.
But they could be comfortable.
They are. You're right. Until somebody stands on the back, and they are the most painful thing you will ever experience. And if you wear flip flops, I hope that happens so you're reminded why they are a very bad choice.
All right, two more quick questions for you here. You had no TV hosting experience before Queer Eye.
No.
And you're doing great.
Thank you.
But for all those folks out there listening who might have dreams of grandeur, what's your message to them?
Don't be desperate. That's how I got my job, because I didn't really think I needed it or wanted it. And then once you've got it, learn as much as you can as quickly as physically possible. I was trying to quit the job for the first few weeks because I thought that I sucked so hard at it. And then I realized it was just because I didn't understand what was happening on set every day. So put your pride aside, don't pretend you know everything, and just ask questions to make sure you're the very best host you can be.
Learn.
Yes.
Okay, one other thing I want to do. It's something that Mama RuPaul does from time to time on her show. She holds up a picture. So I'm going to hold up a picture. Here's a picture of a young Tan.
Yeah.
Circa age 7.
Yeah.
What would you say to that little Tan today?
That little Tan today, I would say, you continued crossing your legs as much as you want, young man, and don't let anybody tell you that you've got to butch it up.
That's Tan France. He's one of the 5 fabulous stars of Netflix's Queer Eye. He's out with a new memoir, Naturally Tan, and he's in town for a sold-out Harvard Bookstore event. There's more information about the book at our website, radioboston.org. Tan France, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use. And we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Give it a try. 617-917-4717.
As we mentioned at the top of the show today, we're marking the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion. This morning, world leaders gathered at the Normandy American Cemetery to honor the living and remember the thousands who perished that day. Fire, fire. Sound there of the 21-gun salute from this morning's Normandy ceremony. There for the ceremony was Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch, who we spoke with just moments ago about what it means to be there today.
I'll tell you, this has been very, very emotional. I'm on Juneau Beach right now. There's a joint ceremony between the U.S., the British, the Canadians, the French, the Polish, and Norwegian governments, that all the forces that participated at the invasion of Juneau. We had the ceremony this morning at Omaha Beach with the U.S. and French governments. So it's really been just remarkable, you know, to actually be here and see the actual circumstances of, you know, and the ground and the beach where so many of our sons perished on D-Day. It's a very, very emotional. I didn't expect this, you know, because it's 75 years ago, but really, really powerful example, and the connection between countries as well. You know, there was a certain bond, I think, that was created, you know, during that whole experience for our nations, and it's very palpable here.
Well, Congressman, I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, in World War II, we saw the Allied forces come together to defeat the Nazis, who represented this kind of existential threat to humanity. And at the top of our show today, we heard a little bit from Supreme Commander of Allied Forces Dwight Eisenhower from his D-Day message. And I just want to play another piece from his message to the Allied forces before the invasion.
The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory.
And, you know, there's been a lot of conversation lately over whether we're alienating some of our allies on the global stage. Is there a lesson here about the importance of allies?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that this example, D-Day, when our very freedoms were at stake, it was the fact that the United States and Great Britain, France, the democracies of the world stepped forward and, you know, just changed history and saved the freedoms that we enjoy today. But they were purchased at a very high cost. I don't know if people understand that or appreciate that. I think sometimes we take it for granted. But this was a time, D-Day, when our freedoms actually hung in the balance. You know, we had a fascist dictator and Hitler and a whole different view of humanity and what people's rights were and how people were viewed.
And for you as a U.S. congressman, you mentioned it was emotional, but what were you hearing from the U.S. veterans who were there today?
No, just unbelievable. So five of them received the Legion of Honor from President Macron, and it was really, and they read the descriptions of their conduct under fire, very, very powerful. And also the Battle Monuments Commission was able to identify a half dozen of my neighbors from South Boston, families, you know, sons of South Boston who died on D-Day. So I was able to visit their graves and say a prayer and pay respects. So there was a local dimension to this as well.
And, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about how we care for veterans and whether we're providing enough support for them when they return home. And actually, on our show on Monday, we're going to be talking to the head of the VA, Robert Wilkie. So I'm just wondering if, you know, thinking about D-Day and veterans, if you have a message for the head of the VA.
Well, we just had, so my committee, I'm the chairman of the National Security Subcommittee, and we just did a hearing about 3 weeks ago on veteran suicide. And, you know, I was in Afghanistan not long ago, and I met some Marines there that were on their seventh tour of duty, you know, being on the front line over and over and over again has to have a, you know, a corrosive effect on your, you know, psychiatric well-being. And I think we don't put the resources in there that we need to. So, you know, we've got about 3 million veterans who have served since the Gulf War. And, you know, this steady drumbeat of suicides is a warning to us. And I think we have to change up the way we're addressing the psychiatric and psychological needs of our returning veterans. I think that transition period is really much more precarious than we assume.
I want to read another quick excerpt here from a letter that Eisenhower famously wrote. It's In Case of Failure. And he wrote, "My decision to attack at this time and place was based upon the best information available. The troops, the air, and the Navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone." I'm just wondering, from you, Congressman, as a leader in our community, as a U.S. representative, what lesson you hear there about the weight of holding public office?
You know, thank God for Ike, you know, holding that coalition together and also taking on that responsibility because it was his call. It was his call. They were going to wait another 3 weeks if they didn't get this tied on June 6, 1944. So.
Yeah, and finally, Congressman, you know, as we mentioned, this is the 75th anniversary of D-Day, and as many have noted, it's perhaps also the last major milestone anniversary that could include living veterans who were there, who will still be around for a commemoration. And so I'm wondering, finally, why it is important to remember this day, and what would you like people to be thinking about as they reflect on D-Day?
Well, there were about 100 D-Day veterans there today, and yeah, they were all in there. Upper 90s, you know, some of them in amazingly good shape, apparently. But, you know, I would just ask people to think about what it took for them to just put their lives aside. And the stories we kept hearing over the weekend, when we asked what they were thinking when they were coming in on those LSTs, they said, well, I should have been graduating with my graduation class. It was the first week of June, and that was our high school graduation, and I had signed up. Many of them had lied about their age, and just the heroic conduct here, people stepping up for the benefit of others, stepping up on behalf of their fellow Americans.
Congressman Stephen Lynch represents the 8th Congressional District of Massachusetts. He joined us from Normandy, France, the site of the D-Day invasion. Congressman Lynch, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jamie.
And joining us now to reflect more on the importance of the day is Andrew Basevich. He's a professor emeritus of military history at Boston University and a retired U.S. Army colonel who spent more than 20 years in active service as an Army officer, including during the Vietnam War. Andrew Basevich, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, thanks very much.
So you've served. You're an historian. How are you reflecting on today?
Well, I guess three things. First is I'm impressed by the scope, the scale, the magnitude of what Franklin Roosevelt called the mighty endeavor. You know, we've there were thousands of ships, over 1,000 airplanes, 175,000 troops that landed at Normandy. And that's something that we could not do today and certainly will never happen again. So it was an incredible logistics feat.
When you say we couldn't do it today, do you mean just because of the way our military is?
Well, war has changed radically. So one could argue we wouldn't need to do it again. But when you think about the quantity of weaponry, goods, supplies, food, fuel that was assembled in England in order to make this possible, the numbers are truly staggering. Among other things, it was an incredible logistics accomplishment. The second thing I would say is that it's fascinating to me listening to Congressman Lynch talk about the participation of the United States and its allies in this incredible, historically important event without ever mentioning the Soviet Union. Because the fact of the matter is, D-Day could not have happened were it not for the fact that the Red Army had an enormous number of German divisions tied up on the Eastern Front. I mean, the Russian perspective on D-Day, I suspect even today, is why did it take you guys so long to get into the fight? And to say that is not to diminish at all the bravery of those who landed on the beach 75 years ago, but it does provide a slightly different historical context. It's interesting to me that basically Mr. Putin has, for all practical purposes, been excluded from this celebration, again, when in fact, in June of 1944, the Russians were a crucial ally.
So
and I think go ahead.
No, well, I was just going to ask you to, because it was 75 years ago, to remind us of the strategic importance of this one beachhead.
Well, the strategic importance was if the West, here we're talking the Great Britain, the United States, and the Canadians particularly, if the West was going to play a role in liberating Europe from Nazi domination and therefore prevent Europe from becoming entirely the property of Stalin's Soviet Union, then Allied forces needed to gain a foothold on the continent and to begin to fight their way toward Berlin. Getting to Berlin wasn't a key thing, but defeating the Wehrmacht, playing a role in defeating the Wehrmacht, was crucially important strategically, politically, and morally. And so that story of liberation begins at Normandy 75 years ago. My third point, though, is as I listen to all this, I'm just struck by how poignant it all is. Because in some respects, D-Day marks the beginning of the it's the creation story of what we generally refer to as the West. This political partnership bound together by values, liberal values, democracy. In a sense, it all begins at Normandy 75 years ago today. And this entity that we refer to as the West plays a crucial role, not simply in World War II, but in for decades after the war, throughout the Cold War, when the Soviet Union is no longer an ally, but now an adversary. And I cannot help but think that that story is now coming to an end. You know, in the age of Donald Trump, with the United Kingdom arguing about Brexit,
right,
with disunity, and in some senses, illiberalism in parts of Europe, this whole idea of the West doesn't seem to have as much resonance as it once did. And to the extent that that's true, you have to feel a little bit sad about that.
You know, earlier in our conversation with Representative Stephen Lynch, we heard Eisenhower, I quoted from the letter that Eisenhower wrote about taking complete responsibility if D-Day was a failure. And I just was struck by that because it's sort of hard to imagine a leader today saying something like that.
You are so right. And that's why that statement, which fortunately he never had to issue, is so admirable and I think even today inspiring. So here was a leader bearing enormous responsibilities, contemplating the possibility of failure, and committing himself in advance to assuming responsibility for that failure, personal responsibility. And in our present political moment, whether we're talking about civilian leaders or military leaders, it really is almost impossible to imagine anybody showing that sense of responsibility. And it's a telling reminder, I think.
Another thing that I found interesting to think about today on the 75th anniversary of D-Day was this idea that they were 18, 19-year-old, essentially boys storming the beach in an event that changed the course of history, and that they were willing to make this ultimate sacrifice. And so just in thinking about those who go abroad to fight and then come back home today, what more should we be doing to support and care for them?
Well, I don't know that I would exactly frame the question that way, even though you're touching on a very important subject.
So how would you frame it?
The issue here is that those who fought and won the war were citizen soldiers. They were citizens, our fellow citizens who for a brief period of time donned the uniform. My father served in World War II. He was doing convoy escort duty. He wasn't at Normandy. My mother served. She was in the Army Nurse Corps, served in the Pacific. When my father died, my mother married my stepfather, served at Normandy with the 101st Airborne Division. These were not professional military people. They were citizens in uniform. And that's worth thinking about, because, of course, today that's not the military we have. The military we have today consists of professionals. And we have come to accept, I think wrongly, we've come to accept the fact that the military is they and we are somehow different, set apart.
Because it can be so easy to sort of separate out, you know, that's happening over there, but it might not affect so many millions of Americans.
It doesn't affect us. I mean, we mouth platitudes about supporting the troops. We certainly do care to a considerable degree about ensuring that, you know, soldiers who are hurt, injured, damaged, to get the VA services. But in World War II, one of the striking aspects of World War II, and not just World War II, it was true in World War I, it was true in the Civil War, was a bond between the military and the American people. And somehow that bond was at the very core of the way of the American way of war. And after Vietnam, that bond went away. It has never been restored. The loss tends not to be acknowledged. And guess what? Despite the enormous capacity of our present-day military, when we look at the range of contingencies, interventions, small wars, medium-sized wars that we've been engaged in since the abandonment of the citizen-soldier concept, we don't win very often. And that, too, seems to me to be something that really deserves to be talked about a lot more than it is. There's something wrong with our military system. And when I say military system, I mean the way we go about forming our military. It seems to me that you can make an argument that it doesn't necessarily serve the interests and well-being of the American people today.
Well,
that citizen soldier, that citizen army that fought in World War II and won decisively, well, they certainly served the interests of the United States quite admirably.
So, Professor Emeritus of Military History at Boston University, Andrew Bacevich, you've given us a lot to think about here on the 75th anniversary of D-Day. So thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it.
You bet.
This week, the House Judiciary Committee announced a bipartisan investigation into antitrust violations by big tech companies, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. Both the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission are also considering their own investigations into these companies. A number of Democratic presidential candidates, including Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar and Senator Bernie Sanders, are proposing more oversight of the tech industry and possible breakup of some big tech companies. So for more on this, let's turn to Hiawatha Bray. He's a tech writer for the Boston Globe, and he joins us now from the Globe. Hi, Hiawatha.
Hello there.
Thanks for joining us. So we've seen these calls for the big breakup of these companies for some time now. What is it about this particular moment that Congress and others are hoping to do, and what's changed?
Well, I don't know what they're going to do, and I think that's half the problem. I don't think they know what they're going to do either, but we are certainly reaching this moment of critical mass in which the entire political landscape is shifting in very bad ways for these guys. Well, maybe not bad for the rest of us, but you now have bipartisan consensus forming around the idea that that these companies are too powerful and have too much influence. I want to be clear. I think there's a huge difference when you look at the two social networks and I'm thinking specifically of Google and Facebook.
Okay.
Now, Apple and Amazon raise antitrust issues of their own, and they're going to be looked at too. But those are almost like child's play compared to the problems raised by Google and Facebook.
And why is that? Why do you see it that way?
Well, because Apple and Google and Facebook are in a position that puts them they're unlike anything else that's ever existed before. Apple and Amazon, you can see analogies to other kinds of companies. But what we're facing with Google and Facebook is a double-barreled crisis. First, both of these companies know huge amounts about the everyday lives of literally billions of people, and so they can use that information to shape the world around us. But secondly, both of these companies are the ones that provide us with what we know about the rest of the world. They tell us what they think we ought to know. And so they can use both of these amazing powers that they have to influence the world in ways that no business and even no government has ever been able to do before. Apple and Amazon don't have power even remotely like that.
So then focusing on those two companies, how feasible is it actually to do this? I mean, is it too little, too late?
That's scary. Yeah, that's what's so worrisome, because of the nature of how these businesses work, because what they do is so different from any earlier business in terms of how they operate, it's extremely difficult to think of any way you can actually solve this problem. People talk, for example, about breaking up Facebook by forcing them to sell off some of the companies they bought, like Snapchat or Instagram.
I mean, even one of the co-founders of Facebook has suggested this, Chris Hughes.
That is absolutely correct. But let's suppose you did that. So what? Facebook itself would remain, and they have information on 2 billion people. They're still right there. They're as powerful as ever. Well, they're not quite as powerful because they're not collecting all the information from Instagram and WhatsApp. It would trim their power somewhat, but their core power would be virtually untouched by something like that.
So what would you have Congress
do? I don't know. Suppose you wanted to break up Facebook, for example. How would you do it? The whole point of Facebook is that you can reach everybody. If you break it up, it's no longer particularly useful as a business. And the same thing applies to Google. How in the world? Well, no, Google, again, you could use the same strategy. You could order Google to sell off, for example, YouTube, which would be a hugely they collect a huge amount of data through YouTube.
Well, I could see a world where Android is spun off, or yeah, YouTube is spun off.
Yes, Android, that's another one. Android could be spun off. That might actually have more traction than the idea of going after these things owned by Facebook. And you can make a respectable case for saying you can't own both the search engine and YouTube. And that might have some useful influence. But even whatever is left behind is still going to have huge amounts of power over what we know and how we know things. And it's not clear that we can completely solve this problem that way. But it would help, I think, to at the very least say that you can no longer acquire any more media companies and to at least consider the possibility of forcing them to sell off the ones they already own. But it won't completely solve the problem because the core company's power will still remain.
Well, Hiawatha, we're rapidly running out of time, so I want to make sure ask you this one final question here. You know, when we think about the breakup of companies and telecommunications, I think of AT&T and the Bell system. And,
right.
And so I'm just wondering if what lessons we can draw from past efforts to do this for today in 2019.
Well, I think that in many cases it has worked out better than a lot of people would have expected. When Microsoft was put under that consent decree, they were complaining that it was going to weaken the entire tech sector. In fact, the tech sector thrived after that happened. When AT&T was broken up, the tech sector thrived after that happened. And IBM won the second big antitrust case that was brought against IBM, but in the process they had to change their business practices so dramatically that they paved the way for the entire software industry. You know, IBM used to not let other companies sell software for their computers. They stopped that, and suddenly a whole new competitive industry was formed. Something like that might be possible.
So it could be good for the industry. Hiawatha Bray is a tech writer.
It could be good if we can figure out how to do it.
Yeah. Hiawatha Bray, tech writer for the Boston Globe. We're out of time. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Jamie Bologna. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, Maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.